Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goal Hanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, James Holland, and I haven't got my normal sidekick, Al Murray, here today, who's gone AWOL. He's headed north on a secret mission. But I am joined by Paul Dixon, who has written a brilliant book called The Rise of the GI Army, 1940 to 1941. And this is a fascinating book, because, and it's something that I'm personally particularly interested in, this whole idea that America starts a war very small in terms of kind of global scale, and particularly in terms of its army. Because we always think of the US Army in World War II as being this sort of huge kind of machine, that after Pearl Harbor, it kind of sort of arrives fully formed as the arsenal of democracy. But of course, nothing could be the truth. And Paul, you know, what I find just so fascinating is just how small it is in September 1939.
It's number 17 in the world after Portugal, and it's in dismal shape. 3 years earlier, Chief of Staff Douglas MacArthur actually said that the army was so small that it could fit in Yankee Stadium, which is one of the larger baseball stadiums in New York City. But it was a mess. If you enlisted in the United States Army in the 1930s, you would be paid $21 a month. But if you wanted a rifle that actually worked, if you wanted one that was calibrated and one that had been cleaned and properly restored to combat order, you had to buy it from the army. And this to me was the great metaphor, and it was over $200. So you had to buy it for months, you know, it's paid for it over months and months and months. If you didn't want to buy a rifle, they gave you some hunk of junk, and you had to figure out how to make it, calibrate it, get it all set to go again, clean it, and get it up to combat readiness, which is very difficult. very difficult. And so I just use that as a metaphor for all the things that were really wrong. The bases were, they had no money. So if you had the Second Army, and one piece of the Second Army was over, you know, in Massachusetts, and another part of the Second Army was in New York State, there was no money to transport them to get together for maneuvers. It was that bad, and the morale was just terrible, and it was a very difficult thing. So that September 1st, 1939. I was born a month earlier, so that's part of my interest in all this. I was born 31 days before the Nazis invaded Poland. And and September 1st is also the day George C. Marshall becomes the chief of staff of the United States Army. And he becomes a very important person, especially in Europe and across the ocean, because he's, you know,
yeah, well, he's chief of staff for the whole of World War II, isn't he? But why is the U.S. Army in such a parlous state? I mean, partly obviously it's because of isolationism, but there is that kind of, after the kind of Treaty of Versailles, there is this kind of sort of inward looking, isn't there, in America? There's this change of tack, and there is this idea that somehow kind of big business had benefited from the kind of blood of American souls in northern France on the Western Front in 1917-18, and you know, there's this kind of sort of inward-looking idea, and there's also this thing that of course, if you have a large army, a large armed forces, you tend to use it, whereas obviously if you don't have one, you don't use it, and I guess there's some truth in that, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, and the other thing about the army itself was it was not a popular idea. There were people, even the American Legion in the late 30s was going to war again. I mean, there were a lot of people who really had been drawn into a war we shouldn't have gotten into, and there were still.
This is the First World War.
First World War, and there was still a lot of evidence of this, of what had, you know, happened. Even when I was a little kid, there were still. I remember my parents had friends, elderly friends who had been, who were still spraying their throats with some sort of medicine because they'd been gassed, and there were amputees on the streets from leftover. You'd see them on crutches. And so it was still a visible presence, yet Europe was so abstract to many Americans at that point, unless they'd come from there to, you know, live here, immigrating. And the other thing was, there was a great prejudice, even among the isolationists, in favor of a strong Navy. Roosevelt himself had been Deputy Secretary of the Navy at one point. He favored the Navy. He was a real Navy guy. And the isolationists believed that what I really wanted is a coastal army, an army that could hold the coasts, and really strong Navy on either coast. So if there was a two-ocean war or whatever we were going to get into, we could remain apart from it because of a very strong Navy. So,
and the Navy is quite strong in 1939,
yeah,
isn't it?
And the other thing is, the Navy, I'll talk about it later, but there was a purge of officers right before Pearl Harbor, of senior officers who were inefficient or alcoholic or couldn't leave their men, etc. If you were in the Navy, there was no need for a purge because the officers, if they didn't know how to control a ship, they would run aground. They were on display every hour of the day while they were at sea, as to whether or not they were capable. So the Navy purged as it went along. And that became, you know, so it was a much stronger entity.
But with the army, you've got none of that, have you? I mean, the officer class is pretty dismal, isn't it, in 1939, for the most part?
Yeah, it is.
I mean,
is,
you've got some very talented guys, obviously, but particularly that junior level, it's pretty wanting.
Well, the other thing was, what was coming along was an amazing deal was made in when Roosevelt came into office. He wanted this thing called the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yeah, the CCC.
Which was to rebuild America, was to replant the Dust Bowl, to build parks, to build trails, to build golf courses, to plant, you know, millions of, I think they planted 3 million trees to reforest the country. And this was Roosevelt's pet project. When he came in, he said to, he didn't have anybody to lead it. He envisioned hundreds of thousands of young men in this tree army, he called it. And he went to MacArthur, who was then chief of staff, and he said, could you guys with the army run this tree army? And MacArthur said, no, you can't do that. And he said, if you want me to run the CCC, I need those guys to run the CCC. So he saves, in the process, he saves Patton, Eisenhower, Mark Clark, Omar Bradley, I mean, right up and down the line. And immediately these guys, Marshall is immediately sent in to run these camps. And it runs camps on either coast and gets this phenomenal sort of lesson in how to lead men without punishment. In other words, if you had the CCC was organized like an army unit, but you couldn't punish them. If you told a CCC guy to pick up the cigarette butt he'd thrown on the ground and he said, no, I won't do it, the army guy, you'd go to the brig if you would disobey the officer. And the CCC, the guy would say, hey, I'm going home. You can't punish. So he had to learn this whole business of dealing with his men and going to bat for them and teaching them sort of a work ethic and teaching them a discipline. So that was one of the things.
A discipline where they're buying into that. That's the point, isn't it?
Right, right. And I mean, if you fast forward the piece of the book that's about the CCC, if you fast forward, the CCC creates these guys who are now disciplined. They've had their teeth fixed, which was no small thing in those days because of the depression and the lack of money and the poor for dental health and such. And they're basically, they understand the work ethic, they understand a day's work, they understand discipline, they understand formations, they have this concept. And so what happens is, when the war comes along, they become the non-commissioned officers. They're the backbone. Mark Clark says after the war that those CCC guys became really the non-commissioned officers all the way through the Army. And many of those who didn't ended up being the foremen and the work stewards and such at the defense plants that were producing aircraft and such, because they had this.
Well, I remember when I was interviewing American veterans of the North Africa campaign, literally every other one had been in the CCC. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. Yeah. I mean, all those guys in Tukor in Tunisia.
Yeah,
I mean, loads of them have been in the CCC. And I remember I got to know very well these two identical twins called Tom and Henry Bowles. And they were in the big red one. They're in the 1st Infantry Division. But they'd been in the CCC beforehand. You know, they were just kind of poor kids from Alabama whose mum had died. You know, mother had died when they were young. And then their dad had tried to kind of bring them up on his own. And it just seemed the obvious thing to do, to go off and join the army. But they joined the CCC first, you know, and then.
Yeah. And it was a salvation. I mean, you can still, when you travel around America, you can still find picnic groves and parks where the CCC built picnic tables and outdoor fireplaces and, you know, barbecue pits and things. And, the mountain trails all over America. They built these mountain trails. So that was a thing that really happened. It really changed Marshall. Marshall really learned the essence of dealing with men, and he proves it.
And dealing with a future conscript army, because the point about a conscript army is they're conscripts. You know, they're not there because they want to be. They're there because, you know, they've got to be, and that's a different thing. And so, how do you get someone from a democratic Western nation? How do you get them to be willing to go and fight up some ghastly mountain in the Apennines in Italy, for example? I mean, you know, it's a really hard thing, and it's amazing that this is where the origins of that are, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, in the CCC and these projects, and people like Marshall kind of getting to grips with this.
And you know, I just jumped one more tiny little metaphor or idea from the CCC was that Marshall, one of the things he learned about these kids that he was bringing, and I mean kids literally, that he brought in was the tremendous impact that film had on the movies. And in the movies and getting them ready, they made special movies about planting trees and about this and about everything. And they would show them, you know, popular Hollywood type movies as well. But he realized the importance of film on morale and on coherent force. One of the brilliant things that Marshall does before Pearl Harbor is he recruits Frank Capra, probably the greatest filmmaker of his time, of the pre-war period. I mean, worldwide, probably the greatest single filmmaker. And he recruits him to make propaganda films for the Army. And he made a series of films, which you can look up today on YouTube, called Why We Fight. And that was he knew right away. He understood all this stuff right away about dealing with these men as he built this army. And that was just one tiny little piece of it, but revealing.
And also, I mean, you know, we're talking about the army, but we also should just mention the Army Air Corps, as it was in 1939, which obviously becomes the U.S. Army Air Force and later the U.S. Air Force. But I mean, that is also absolutely titchy, isn't it, in 1939? I think the day that Germany goes into Poland, I think the USA has something like 74 fighter planes. And
oh, it's a dreadful mess. And even fast forward to later on, even when you get to a major portion of what I wrote about, which is the Louisiana maneuvers, these monstrous maneuvers, which we'll get to in a second. But even then, even when they get to Louisiana, a couple months before Pearl Harbor, the Army Air Corps and the Army Air Corps and aviation don't talk to each other. They're not even on the same radio frequencies. They can't even do operations together. I mean, there's this totally random sort of, you know, development of these two groups without any coherence. And the men themselves, even months before Pearl Harbor, when they're in maneuvers, it takes them weeks and weeks to get it through their heads that when a plane comes overhead, you're supposed to take cover. And even then, the men were running out with, you know, they'd have Kodak Brownie cameras. They'd run out, the attacking aircraft, the maneuvers were coming out to, you know, drop flour bags on them and you know, attack them. The guys, they'd run out and take snapshots of the plane. So all of this had to be developed before the United States could go into North Africa. All of this sort of skill. With a citizen army. This was not a professional army. This was an army of conscripts and volunteers.
So, Paul, I mean, the strategic earthquake, obviously, is the fall of France, isn't it, really, in May and June 1940. And then suddenly you've got this situation where Roosevelt suddenly realises that the Atlantic is not the kind of barrier that it once was, and things need to kind of move very, very quickly. So there is this sudden kind of input of cash. But I mean, I find it absolutely amazing that in those interwar years, I mean, America has almost entirely stopped producing kind of TNT, for example. I mean, it's incredible.
You know, there's, if you really measure it out, it's exactly 494 days between September 1st, 1939, and the invasion of Poland and Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And so you go from this, you know, and during this period, even forgetting the armaments and the munitions and such, but if you just look at that army, it goes from this tiny, tiny army to an army of over 1.2 million the night of Pearl Harbor. And I think the key points here, I think, in allowing that to happen was a civilian, which very few Americans, let alone people overseas, have ever heard of, is a guy named Grenville Clark, who was this very idealistic, very wealthy lawyer, who had worked very diligently in World War I to create a series of schools for taking college graduates and turning them into junior officers. And just as literally early in 1940, or even earlier, he had envisioned this two-ocean war, years ahead of even its happening. He saw this great peril on either ocean. And he's the first one to really step up and say, we need a civilian draft. We need a civilian draft. When he starts it, he's very shrewd. He recruits a committee of 100 very, very influential people, retired generals, heads of major universities, the top guy at the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera, and puts this group together and starts lobbying for a draft. And he's immediately, Roosevelt doesn't like the idea, as opposed to it. Roosevelt wouldn't even use the word a draft or selective service. You'll only say muster, which sounds like something in the Revolutionary War where people come out with muskets or, you know, a muster. It's like, And Marshall was not keen. Marshall thought he could raise a huge army of volunteers by making the army more attractive. But he realized pretty quickly, but in the meantime, Clark starts this machine of creating this draft. And he uses the most extraordinary PR tactics, public relations tactics. He takes the guy who had been the head of public relations for the New York World's Fair in 1939, and he becomes the PR guy for the draft. And they go all around America, and they go on radio stations and local newspapers, and they're pushing. And one of his lines is, Clark has several lines, one of which is, if Britain falls, our culture falls with it. The culture of Shakespeare and Dickens and all the rest of it dies with, and it's replaced by this Germanic culture. That was to appeal to sort of one level. The other level, he said, look, France and Great Britain fall, and the rest of Europe falls, and the Scandinavian countries fall, it's just a matter of time until the Nazis create this huge armada, which will come right up the Potomac River, take Washington, and go to Baltimore, Philadelphia, and to New York, and basically take over the country. And so he gets this, he gets the moves very slowly. Finally, Roosevelt is at the last minute. Roosevelt gives his approval to it. Marshall comes around, and he gets the legislation through, and they immediately go to a registration. This mammoth registration, like nothing that's ever occurred before in America.
Sure.
Every man of a certain age has to register. They could be a quadriplegic. They could be in a mental hospital. They could be in maximum security prison. They had to register, and everybody registers. Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, Roosevelts. Everybody, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, they all register. And then they go through various procedures of you know, making sure they're eligible and so on, and then they start the draft.
So at what point is Grenville Clark kind of really starting this campaign?
He really starts it in early 1940.
So this is before the fall of France.
Yeah, before the fall of France, and it gets passed in September. It takes a long time to get it passed, but he's pushing. It's called the Burke Wadsworth Act, and it passes pretty clearly. The isolationists don't prevail at this point. And by October 16th, they're registering the draft. And then shortly thereafter, they start drafting them. And it's a huge, it's a monumental moment because they start drafting hundreds of thousands at a clip.
Yeah, and this happens before the November election, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and Roosevelt is very concerned that he's going to have. They start pulling numbers out of a fishbowl, and people, you know, your number came up. And what happened was I kept looking for the resistance. There's more resistance in World War One. There's more resistance now in America to wear masks than because of the COVID. There's more,
yeah.
Then for the, I mean, there were religious groups. They were always anti-war, and they were given a special status, and there was a few seminarians. The number of people there who really protested, now the number of people who grumbled and moaned and groaned about it were huge, but everybody, and again the draft comes, the Roosevelt, there's a Vanderbilt, there's a Rockefeller, the head of the New York Stock Exchange is drafted. And it goes up and down. There are very, very few exemptions. If you were a supervisor in an aircraft carrier, you have an exemption. But if you were the head of the largest law firm in Washington, no dice, you went. And this Marshall, once he gets these guys, and he's building the citizens' army, he's got these huge problems because these are people who are, you know, yanked out of jobs as barbers and bankers and butchers and whatever, and with girlfriends and the whole deal, and you know, a nice job and a nice car, and they're thrown into these godforsaken bases, many of which are left over in the far west from the Indian Wars and in some of the most difficult parts of the South.
The upscaling, Paul, is on such a gargantuan level, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so fast. I mean, it's hard to sort of get one's head around it, really. I mean, because if your army is already in a parlous state, and suddenly you've got all these people that have been drafted, you've got to find camps for them. You've got to find uniforms and equipment. But it's not just that. You've got to feed them. You've got to shower them. You've got to kind of keep them healthy. I mean, it's a huge task, isn't it?
It is, and the biggest task that Marshall was faced with was the morale, because it sent somebody to one of these bases, it'd be in the middle of nowhere, and it might be in the Bible Belt, where they didn't allow, you could, in town, you could not watch a movie on Sunday, you could not dance in public, there was no dancing, there was no this, and they're sending all these people, including a lot of urban, northern urban people, and into these bases, and there's no swimming pool, if they're real lucky, there's a movie theater, sort of like Ersatz movie theater. But they've got this huge morale problem. Marshall himself becomes so cognizant of it. There's one point, and I've discovered this one, a 2-day period, he gets on a plane in civilian clothes, goes to one of these southern bases, and goes to the nearby town and wanders through the town, talks. He's in civilian clothes. Here's the chief of staff talking to these guys, and he realizes he's got to get them out in the field. If an army in camp, an army in a camp is a demoralized army. They get up in the morning, they drill for 2.5 hours, they, you know, have a lesson or something, they drill for a little bit more. 3 o'clock, they can do what they want, they go back and read comic books. There's no sense in the whole thing. And that's when he comes up, and there are a whole lot of reasons, but one of the reasons was that he comes up with the maneuvers. So beginning in the spring of 1941, he starts these massive, massive maneuvers.
Sure.
They go through the South, and they start in Tennessee, mm-hmm. in the mountains of Tennessee, and all of these maneuver areas replicate some potential war zone. The Tennessees would try to replicate northern Europe, more or less, et cetera.
Right.
And then they move down to Louisiana, the swampy, almost desert, you know, jungle-like wilds of Louisiana, where wild boar and poisonous snakes and
alligators and what have you.
All the whole deal. And then they end up in the Carolinas. And they end up in the Carolinas in the fall, going right up to 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor. And the logistics of this are beyond belief. I mean, you put 700,000 men into these maneuvers. In Louisiana alone, there's over 500,000 people of men, and in the army, this doesn't even include the people who, you know, drove the trucks that brought the eggs and the water in. But they were going through 2 million eggs a day, and they were going.
It's amazing, isn't it?
They had trucks and huge trucks outfitted with cobblers, shoemakers, who would go there and repair boots on the scene. I mean, they created this huge logistic thing. Water in Louisiana was not potable, so you had oil tankers filled with water, like a huge pipeline coming out of Texas into Louisiana to give them water. Eisenhower says later that after the war, he said the United States could never move through Europe as it had without the maneuvers, to teach them all about the logistics, all about...
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've been recently writing about the Sicilian campaign. What's amazing about that is there is this moment where 7th Army are given sort of, you know, a free hand to go and clear the western part of Sicily. And, you know, 7th Army is the first field army to be put into the field in World War II. I mean, there have been divisions and, you know, organisations elsewhere in Philippines and so on, but As a U.S. Army, the 7th Army is the first to go into kind of action as an army. And between the 19th and the 23rd of July, it absolutely proves its mettle. And, you know, there's not much opposition in terms of kind of fighting. But in terms of an exercise in logistics, it's absolutely second to none, and they pull it off with bells on. And I'm and you know, who's commanding 7th Army but General George Patton, who of course massively earns more spurs during the Louisiana manoeuvres. So he understands what he's doing. And, you know, it's not just enough in World War II to have a little bit of tactical chutzpah. What you really need to do is understand that kind of operational level of how it all works and how it all fits together and how you supply and how you keep that long tail, which is such a feature of the kind of Allied way of war in World War II, how you keep that going. And, you know, it's fascinating that for the US Army, this is where it's all kind of worked out to start off with.
And you mentioned Patton, right? And Patton is one. I mean, he does amazing things. One of the things he does in the maneuvers, he cheats. In other words, there's one point where his army, towards the end of the Louisiana maneuvers, is supposed to, in this mammoth exercise, supposed to take Shreveport, Louisiana, the city of Shreveport. And instead of going front on and confronting the enemy, the Blue Army, Red Army, he makes this massive end run through Texas, and he pumps gas into the tanks. You know, the tanks were using regular gas station, service station gasoline, shells out his own money to buy gasoline, comes all the way around the back, operates right at night, very dangerous stuff. Years later in Europe, when he's going in to save the 101st Airborne, he writes a letter to one of the newspaper guys in Louisiana. He said, he learned all of these tactics, like running at night without lights, doing all this stuff, all this daring stuff, in Louisiana. That's where he learned to do all this stuff. And in the actual maneuvers, after he does this attack, you know, by going through Texas, going around through Texas, out of Louisiana.
Yeah, yeah.
The judges declare, and you cheated, he's disqualified, he loses. But there's huge amounts of press there, radio and newspaper people and stuff. And of course, they're dazzled by this. They declare him the winner. And everybody knows he's the winner. But one of the staff says later, he says about Hitler, Patton was cheating. He said, well, Hitler's going to cheat, you know. And the other thing, what really was a revelation to me was realizing that Patton's units were almost entirely built of citizen soldiers. They were guys, and he loved them. Patton loved them, and he had this. I mean, he saw them. They would see a truck or a tank or a jeep or a piece of aircraft, and they would immediately want to go under the hood. Immediately want to go in. They were tinkerers. They'd grown up with Model T Fords and Model A Fords, and these World War II guys were born tinkerers. They loved to noodle around with the engines of these vehicles. The other thing was they could read maps, which sounds like a silly little thing, but World War I, the ability of the average guy to read a map was not great. And all of a sudden, these guys had grown up on road maps. They understood topography. They understood distance. They understood a whole lot of things that were not true of a previous army, just because they'd grown up in an automotive age. To me, that part of it was the most fascinating in a way, because the degree that these guys were not meant to be, they were not an army of professional army.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? And but just Paul, just explain exactly how the Louisiana maneuvers kind of, you know, what does that mean? You know, I mean, I know you've got a Red Army and a green and a Blue Army, but 700,000 men, whatever it was. I mean, how does that work? I mean, what are they actually doing? Because I do remember talking to some guys who were involved in that and saying, you know, that planes were dropping kind of bags of flour on them. They only had wooden rifles and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it, really?
It is. But they learned to work as a coherent units. And one example, when they start in, when they're first in Tennessee, the time it takes them to lay a pontoon bridge across a river, a raging river for that matter, is a matter of days. And as they go along, the ability to lay a bridge goes from days to down to hours. And so it's that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing about how do you feed these guys? How do you set up a mess tent? How do you do all the things you're going to need? So the fact of the matter, if the rifles were wooden, and the firing of the rifles were theoretical, that wasn't the most important thing. It was learning how to communicate. It was learning how to go from pigeons to walkie-talkies, and I start to use the light aircraft like the Piper Cubs, which were very instrumental in all during the war, to carry messages, to do certain errands and things. So, and they tested new equipment down there. There was a thing called the Marston mat, which was this perforated aluminum piece of equipment. You would lay out, you could lay out anywhere in the world, in a jungle, wherever, and create a airfield where you could land and launch aircraft.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. And so there was a lot of that stuff going on. And it was also, it was a great time for Marshall, from a distance, to see the officers who couldn't cut it in Louisiana and the Carolinas. And that's when...
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And you're separating the kind of sort of wheat from the chaff a little bit, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's when his famous purge, maybe not so famous, but his purge, of course, is September, October of 41. At the same time, he's raising Eisenhower from colonel. He's raising all these younger, the ones he knows are going to win the war for him.
Yeah, Clark does well, doesn't he? Mark Clark does well in the Louisiana maneuvers.
Yes, and so does Omar Bradley, and so does Grunther, and there are a whole bunch of them. And and that's when he decides to run the purge. So then he's elevating these guys in the very fall of 41. He's elevating these guys and recognizing them. Because don't forget, he's got Eisenhower.
And they're all in their 40s as well, aren't they? I mean, they're all in their, they're pretty much all in their 40s, right, right. Late 40s. So they're the perfect age to kind of take on the mantle of kind of sort of higher command once the U.S. is in the war proper.
And he doesn't, he's only met Eisenhower once in a receiving line. He's been reading reports, he's been talking to people about him, but he has Eisenhower in Washington 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor in the War Plans Division. So he's got him, all these people moving, and the purge is happening at the same time. What's interesting about the purge is during the war, H.G. Wells is writing about who we think of in terms of science fiction and such, but Wells was a student scholar of war, and Wells does say, and writes an article saying that one of the problems was that the Europeans, the exception of the Nazis, but the French and the British and others, never had a purge. And they never got rid of those guys who were in the army because of went to the right school or something.
Right.
And they weren't necessarily the best officer. And he said the brilliance of Marshall was the purge. And it's fascinating to see how he does everything during the war. I mean, I went to this writing and researching this era with great respect for Marshall, but there are things that he did. There's one moment at which he wants to create an officer candidate school. He wants to make Omar Bradley in charge of an officer candidate school, in which he will take the best enlisted men, the one or two or three in 100 who should be platoon commanders, officers, and he wants to run them through this school at Fort Leavenworth, run by Omar Bradley. And Stimson, the Secretary of War, and Roosevelt, the President, say no. And he said, okay, if I can't have that, I need that to win the war. And I'll leave if I can't have it. And he's probably bluffing, but it was just the genius of the guy. And of course, that officer, that Army officer school is still in existence.
Yeah, amazing. It is an extraordinary story, isn't it? And I think what's interesting is that, you know, it's putting that operational level absolutely to the forefront. It's recognizing that you can't fight, you can't do your tactical stuff if you can't work out your long chain, you know, if you haven't got the kind of backup. And it's working that out really, really, really early on. And I just think it's absolutely, it's extraordinary how quickly the US Army develops. And I think it is also amazing, you know, when one thinks that, you know, Congress is sanctioning the purchasing of 20,000 horses in March 1941, You know, it's just, it's got so much growing up to do. And yet, the draft, the manoeuvres, working out what can be done, kind of working out who are the good commanders and who are the ones to kind of keep their eye on and promote and who are the ones to get rid of at that very early stage. They're kind of getting their priorities right. I think that's the point. You know, you can work out weaponry later, but if you haven't got your basics right, the weaponry counts for nothing.
And, you know, the other thing that was going along with this, and Marshall, the rest of them didn't really have that much to do with it, but this huge sense of morale was developing through popular entertainment, music, films.
Bob Hope.
People like Bob Hope, the comedian, who would you know, spend a lot of the war in combat zones entertaining the troops. And there was this, you know, the cartoonists, the great American cartoonists, Bill Malden and others, in Louisiana. And so you've got this culture of the war. You know, you have the, you know, the for early movies about the draft with Abbott and Costello. And, you know, in that movie, there's the, you know, the Andrews sisters, the Bugle Boy, you know, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. And so you've got this country which has, when it was driving the isolationists crazy, in which popular culture was bolstering this whole thing. And these guys, and Bob Hope's great thing was he learns really way before the war starts. Hope knows he could show up in front of a bunch of Army or Navy guys, and the role he plays is he's the coward in front of all these heroes. And he plays this role to the hilt all the way through the war. And at one point, Hope, it becomes a sort of symbol, but Hope has got he's going into combat zones in southern Italy and areas where there are huge numbers of wounded. And he goes in and he's entertaining these really badly wounded guys, some of whom won't live. And the other entertainers can't stand it. They're crying. And he goes in and he's joking and he's just doing everything else to help these guys who are really in terrible, you know, terrible, terrible physical shape. And the one guy is writing about it for one of the New York papers, New York Herald Tribune. It says, when the war is over, Bob Hope will be one of the heroes. Well, the person writing the article was John Steinbeck, you know, the great writer. And it was almost like this moment where you say, wait a second, this war has, you know, you all of a sudden you've got all these people coming together, and they're all sort of, you know, on the side of good morale, and as dreadful as combat was, and as dreadful as the PTSD, which they didn't call that, would be afterwards. It was still that everybody was sort of on one page.
Yeah, I just think that's so interesting because, you know, if you're talking about Nazi Germany, I mean, you get people to do what you want because you're a militaristic totalitarian state, and if you don't do it, you'll get shot. But both the British and you know, the Canadians and Dominion forces and obviously the United States, they don't have that. You know, so you've got to kind of get this conscript army. You've got to get them to do what you want them to do. You've got to make these terrible sacrifices, and you've got to get buy-in. And how do you do that? And it's fascinating, all the stuff about Babel Harbor stuff. But I also think it's really interesting about how they kind of, you know, changed the look of the U.S. Army. You know, so the U.S. Army in 1939, 1940 is still with those kind of sort of the felt scout hats, Tommy helmets, the Brody helmet. It looks kind of old-fashioned. It looks from a different era. It doesn't look modern. And then suddenly you've got this change. You've got the M41 Parsons jacket coming in. You've got the M1 steel helmet. And I think the kind of the whole story of the M1 Parsons jacket, which is trialled in 1940 with the 5th Division under Major General Parsons, is really, really interesting because they also consult the Esquire fashion desk about this. And it's based, the design of it is based on a pre-war civilian wind cheater, you know, the kind of thing that you'd wear around the golf course. Yeah. And that is reflecting, of course, the fact that you've got a civilian army. And they have, you know, they're not imbued with a heritage of regimental history and, you know, buttons and brass and kind of, you know, epaulettes and all the rest of it and gold braid. This is a bunch of civilians. So you want them to be practical and feel comfortable and not feel completely kind of fish out of water with the environment they suddenly find themselves in, even though obviously they are. So that look, that jacket, that kind of the transformation of the look of the army is also about sort of saying, okay, this is something new. We're all in it together and we're all going to change together. We're all going to kind of evolve together. It's not something that's articulated as such, but it is a subtle kind of transformation as well. I mean, all those jackets that they produce in World War II, the Americans, they're all pretty much all based on civilian designs in their first conception. And I think that's utterly fascinating. Whereas you compare that, obviously, to a German tunic at the start of the war, it's all very kind of 19th century in style with its kind of pleats and very militaristic and all the rest of it. The whole Binder Parsons jacket isn't very militaristic. You know, they're recognising that the GI of this new war is a guy off the streets. You know, he's just an ordinary Joe.
And, you know, you can extend that to all different corners of the experience. And for example, yeah. Food. Food was terribly, terribly important.
Yep.
And Marshall took great interest in the feeding of these troops. And if some guy, some private out in the middle of nowhere, wrote a letter to Marshall saying the food here is terrible, he would go right to the commander and say, wait a second. And the guy would be more specific, but he would follow up on it. And it was that kind of thing that made, over time, it a huge difference. They knew that they were going to, I mean, the idea of getting fresh vegetables and stuff to any cost and eggs as opposed to, you know, they had to go to powdered eggs in Europe.
Right.
But it was all part of getting the, you know, Marshall made sure the movie theaters went in and all this as soon as the base went up, you know.
Yeah, and you know you can go to East Anglia in England now, and you can still go to some of the you know, the old airfields of the mighty 8th, the 8th Air Force, and yeah. There's still the kind of the old shed that was converted in the war to a cinema,
yeah.
You know, because that's important, yeah. And you know I mean when the British troops were being transported by Americans to Sicily. They were absolutely gobsmacked to find there was ice cream on deck and Coca-Cola and all the rest of it. I mean, Coca-Cola was absolutely everywhere. Wherever the US Army went, there was Coca-Cola. And I remember reading about General Oliver Lees, who was commander of 8th Army in Italy in 1944. And he goes over to visit Wayne Clark, you know, who's commander of the US 5th Army. And Clark's got this very swanky caravan. And Lees goes into it, and it's all kind of beautifully well appointed and everything. And the first thing, and he's got a fridge in his caravan, and Lees just cannot get over this. You know, just this amazing modernity that here's Mark Clark with a fridge in his own caravan, and he says, you know, would you like a Coca-Cola? And Lees goes, yeah, that would be marvelous, thank you, and has a Coca-Cola with him, a chilled Coca-Cola in the afternoon in the kind of, you know, Italian sunshine, and he just thinks this is just beyond comprehension. I mean, but it's amazing. But of course, morale is just so vital, you know, particularly when you, I mean, it's vital whatever walk of life, but it's particularly vital when you've got a large conscript army from a democratic nation. And, you know, the Brits need their cups of tea and the Americans need their Hershey bars and Camel cigarettes and Coca-Cola and ice cream and stuff. And you know, I think that is all to the, you know, you know, historians have kind of sort of rubbished that, sort of going, you know, they were soft compared to the kind of hard-nosed, hard-boiled Germans and all the rest of it. I just go, well, that's just genius of the kind of, you know, the high command of the US Army and George Marshall and all the rest of it leading the charge, that they're looking after their guys. You know, I think that's just basic common sense, and that applies to anything, any business, anything. You know, if you haven't got good morale, you've got no business.
You know, one of my favorite little tidbits about all this stuff with Marshall was, right at the beginning of the drafting period, he creates something called the Soldier's Handbook, which has got a lot of interesting stuff in it about, you know, and it talks to them in a way that no other Army manual has ever talked to them in terms of why they should obey certain orders and what the consequences are, but doing it in such a way that, you know, it explains why there are these orders and such. But the genius of the book, which was based on the Boy Scout manual, it was a replica of the Boy Scout manual, even down to the trim size and the look of the cover. In the back of it, he's got a soldier's vocabulary. And Marshall is listed as the editor of the book. I mean, he had his hand in the whole thing. In the back of it, he's giving these guys a slang.
Right.
You know, over the hill for deserter, it's this chow, his food. I mean, he's giving him this long list, and he gives him a slang. Now, what he's doing, which is so obvious to anyone who's ever even taken a poke at language, is that slang and jargon create a cohort that's more powerful than one that doesn't have its own language.
Yeah, so, sure. So suddenly you're part of a gang, aren't you? A special, exclusive gang.
Right. And it also identifies, it goes right down to Kilroy was here, you know, that kind of thing. Right. Where the Americans, just like the RAF had its own slang, which everybody, you know, knew, and the world knew about, the RAF sort of aviation slang, which a lot of it transmitted to the American aviators and such. But it was the GI slang that was, you know, all over the world.
Yeah, amazing. Well, Paul, I think it's just fascinating. I'm really glad you did all this work, because I'd sort of dipped into it a bit myself, and this whole idea of the sort of the growth of the United States in the first couple of years of the war, you know, and how they developed, how quickly they developed. But your book really opened my eyes to a kind of to this to a whole different degree, and I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I do completely buy into your argument about morale, or rather George Marshall's argument about morale. I mean, it's so vital, and it's just fascinating stuff. So thank you very much for coming on, and do come on again, please do.
Thank you so much. I'm glad this has been most fun.
Great. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and cheerio.